young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
Not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone.
Each night we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with something called solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues that face us every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast, and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
Not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Theodore O'Malley with us. He is the author of Doing Virtuous Business, The Remarkable Success of Spiritual Enterprises. He's the chairman and CEO of the Roosevelt Group, a strategy firm, and a research professor at Yale University, where he leads the Spiritual Capital Initiative. He was vice president for all of national programs for the Aspen Institute, served on the executive board of the World Economic Forum. He's had an ambassadorial level position in the United Nations and senior policy positions at the U.S. Senate Committee on Foreign Relations and the U.S. Department of State. And let us say, Theodore, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being, I don't know if I could say ambassadorial four times, but we can try. Okay, let's say doing virtuous business. The word virtuous, how do you tie that into business today? Business today is very quick to take the direction that's going to cause the business's bottom line, the return of investment, to increase. What do you do to get people to slow down and say, take a look at your life? And there is a way to do business where we all come out together.
Well, that indeed is the whole thesis of this book, with about 60 different case studies and stories about companies that are doing it in every industry, public and private companies, small, medium, and large, on all the continents of the earth. So there are companies doing it and succeeding well. I would say, while there's still a very strong emphasis on maximizing profit, these companies are also interested in maximizing purpose. So sometimes there's a tension between the two, and they make that trade-off, and they do various things in terms of practice, but they're not focused exclusively on profit. So they have a very long-term vision.
Okay, so effectively, the getting together is on purpose. They're looking for an end result. Now, in essence, do they involve the employees? Is this something where we're talking about a contributory process goes into effect and everybody seems to be part of the business?
I think the most successful companies of this sort do. They involve a whole set of stakeholders. So employees are the key amongst them, but also the vendors and the communities where they operate and, you know, all the people that are connected to the company, not just the shareholders. But they have a very keen interest in their employees, and a lot of these companies treat their employees very well. So, you know, for instance, Herman Miller, the large office furniture company, is the most admired company, you know, year after year. It's on that top list, anyway, of Fortune magazine. And there are other companies in that category, and they really do well by their employees, not just in terms of respect and dignity, all those kinds of categories, but also in terms of remuneration, paying them and benefits, and people want to work there. You know, they're actually people waiting in line to go to work for these kinds of companies.
Yeah, we live in a multinational world at this stage of the game, Theodore, and when we do business, it's not only with the people that we deal with here, but obviously across the pond, and we are dealing internationally. How do you get that balance, that homeostasis between a business that has a morality based center of purpose for doing business. And somebody, let's go to China for a moment. Look at all of the goods that have come through China that have been poisoned, that have been, you know, they just haven't been that good. And that can't
be
based
on morality. Yeah. No, actually, I was in China, and the premier of China asked me to come and speak about Adam Smith and the theory of moral sentiments. His argument was, and this was to a large audience of 3,000 Chinese business people, he was very concerned about the corruption and the shoddy goods that were coming out of China. And they're arguing in China, not just he, but others, that they need to have a kind of morality of capitalism. They can't have this kind of raw cowboy capitalism because it will harm China in the long run. So they're actually onto that already. There are some transformations. Of course, China is such a big company, country that sometimes things, you know, take a different pattern or take a long time to evolve.
Now, as somebody comes into a company, and as a matter of fact, not just the employee, but somebody on a managerial level, an executive level, how do you get that same experience across? The faith, the honesty, the gratitude, the perseverance, the compassion, all those things.
Right.
That come into play when you were dealing with a company that's going to come from the heart?
Well, a lot of these companies are founded with those kinds of virtues. So in other words, they're there at the inception, and they're built by the founders right into the DNA of the company. And then many of them last a very long time. It is interesting, you know, we talk about the durability or built to last. A lot of these companies have lasted a very long time, some of them even 150 years or more. So what they do exceptionally well in their corporate culture is to inculcate these kinds of value, these kind of virtues in actually the entire management structure. So they're constantly training and perpetually learning. And I mean, a company like Johnson & Johnson, which certainly has had its ups and downs, but has, you know, the categories that I'm talking about here, they have a credo that has all of these features built into it, and they actually have seminars every week at Johnson & Johnson about their credo. So they don't stop talking about it. They actually constantly bring it to attention.
So effectively, there's a mindset going in, and these people are reminded of the mindset. And I would imagine that the people that are hiring the new people coming in at whatever level they are have this mindset behind them, and they'll recognize it within someone else.
Oh, yeah, when you're recruiting, so you're looking for certain kinds of people, obviously certain kinds of skills and competency. But a lot of these companies would also be looking at people that have very strong character. There's one company, in fact, that has a whole program around character first, and they try to build these virtues. And this is a oil and gas company, so it's a blue-collar, you know, working company, but they try to build these values into the workforce. What it has done in that company is actually a turnaround kind of situation, whereas before they were suffering losses and absenteeism, a lot of alcoholism. Now the company is thriving, and people are actually not only happy to go to work, but they're doing a great job.
Now, by the way, when the program that you created, the Spiritual Capital Initiative, what exactly is that? Why was it? What triggered you to build this in the first place, to create it, and then what does it do now?
Well, this is a very large research program over a couple of years at Yale University, interdisciplinary in nature. We made a PBS documentary on this topic, Doing Virtuous Business, which will air nationally on May 22nd. So that's the first thing. The second thing is we're writing 24 new business cases about these kinds of companies that other universities, particularly business schools around the country and around the world, will use so they can teach, in fact, from a different paradigm and show that there are all kinds of companies out there from different perspectives, different industries doing these kinds of things. There's no one that's perfect, so there's all kinds of examples. And then the third thing is we're working with the European Academy of Business on a program called Practical Wisdom for Management in the Six Great Faith Traditions of the World. So we're actually holding conferences in six different regions around the world looking at Hinduism and Buddhism and Islam, Judaism, and Christianity. And those will be very interesting kinds of dialogues to have. We've started doing that. We're going to be doing two this summer, one in Israel and one in Morocco. So it's a very rich program based on research and based on a very large grant from a foundation that made it all possible.
The religions that you just mentioned are so vastly diverse. When you talk
spiritual,
Yeah. Absolutely, no question. But when you talk spirituality, spirituality would have to be the essence of what religion is. Can you move that with the different religions to get to the point where underneath it all, underneath the bureaucracy of the religion, lies that same essence that touches us all, and that would have to be that same essence that touches the success of a business. How do you get to that? That's got to be a tough way to go.
That is, in fact, one of the challenges. We're going to have a very large conference of all six faith traditions at Yale in 2013, where we try to bring some of them together in this kind of deep conversation. I believe that the spiritual capital concept actually is helpful in having that fruitful dialogue. And actually, when you look at the virtues, I'm not talking about the dogma and all the religious trappings or some of the theological beliefs, but if you look at some of the virtues, they're almost universal virtues. They take different tones, of course, but they're present in many of these world religions. And I would argue that you need that kind of honesty and that kind of trust if we're going to continue in this integrated global economy, which in fact is the path we're going down, where we trade with people halfway around the world.
Now, what we do is we compete for dollars, obviously. That's the major competition. And to move everybody into that different mindset, the different thought about the purpose for why they're in business and what they're doing has got to be another major challenge also.
Yeah, no, I mean, we're talking about bringing together here an academic group of people and a group of CEOs, obviously, who correspond to those different traditions, and then possibly a group of religious leaders as well. So it's a very interesting, deep conversation. I don't think that we're going to solve all the problems. That's not the indication. But I think that no one before has ever attempted this kind of deep conversation between this kind of audience. And I think we're going to let the media in to have a sneak preview to see what we're thinking.
By the way, if you can touch the audience at this level, obviously it's going to have its trickle-down effect. It's going to also have them really take a look at the, you know, what drives them on a personal level too. I have found in my experience over the years, whatever drives you at home is going to be that same drive in business, and it's a reversible cause and effect. So if you set up, if you set up that, I'm going to use the word mindset again because that's what it is. If you set up that mindset within business, the employees are involved in it, they take that home. And if they can take that home, they're going to take it to politics. And if they take it to politics, then we're going to clean up a lot of what goes on here today.
It has a lot of ramifications.
You know, absolutely it does. A couple of things. You write about hard virtues, leadership, discipline, et cetera, and there's got to be discipline, no question about that. But you also talk about soft virtue. Well, what is a soft virtue?
Well, the soft virtues are things sometimes people don't think correspond to business practices. They're not, you know, the first things that come to mind. Some people call them more feminine virtues. I'm talking about justice, forgiveness, compassion, humility, which is very critical, and gratitude. So there's a set of virtues there that some companies display very admirably, and I think we can learn a lot because when companies display some or all these virtues to some degree, they're actually better performers.
Okay, when we talk about performance, and especially in the marketplace, now we're going to have to go up against other people who don't, not only do they not believe in what we're saying here, and I have to say what we're saying, I'm on your side of the table here, what we're saying here, but we'll battle against it. So you can get a mindset going with a certain amount of businesses. Again, it's the challenge to cross that line in the sand where they think if they do this, it's not going to change their way of living their life. And it will change the way they live their life once they begin to think this way.
Well, a lot of companies, you could say, would come to the conclusion that this is all, you know, well and good, but it really defeats the purpose of competition, and that's a dog-eat-dog world. And if you did these kinds or practice these kinds of virtues, if you could practice them in business, and there are companies that do, that it would cost so much that it would affect their business. Well, what we did is, at the end of the book, we took the 60 companies that I had analyzed, and we ran them against the S&P. Their performance, most of them were public. Some of them we had a proxy because they're private. But we looked at their performance vis-a-vis the S&P 500 for the last 10 years. And they outperformed the S&P 500 by 20%. Then we asked, well, how do they do vis-a-vis their largest competitor? Because that's a more interesting indicator. They outperformed their largest single competitors by 24%. So the conclusion is that this kind of virtue, if it's practiced, and I'm not saying it's uniform,
sure.
But if it's practice, actually pays dividends.
Oh, and if we look at this, when we talk about it this way, this is the structure, that foundation that would run the business. Now, did they come into this accidentally? And when I say accidentally, or were they intentional when they formed the businesses? You're talking some major businesses here.
Yeah, and I am. And most of them are intentional. They happen at the time of the birth of the company. So you have some incredible stories about the founders or the families, even as they go public, and how they keep those, you know, core values, and how they're, you know, practicing them and living by them. So there are companies that are turnaround situations. So I'm not saying it's impossible. Obviously, in our economy, there are mergers and acquisitions. One of the companies I talked about just a few minutes ago, Johnson & Johnson, acquired a new company today for $21 billion. So we have a very robust economy with lots of transactions. So, you know, what happens when you acquire a new company with a different culture? What happens when you divest a company? What happens when you have a new startup? Well, that's, of course, a very critical question. We have all these new media companies and all these new internet companies. Well, they, too, were founded. They all have a history.
No, we're starting to run out of time, but what we're looking at also, the timing for the book, I think your window of opportunity is good. We went from mom and pop, got eaten up by the corporations, in essence, got eaten up by the multinational corporations, et cetera, and people are going to become mom and pop again and start to regrow. And if they can have this foundation as part of the regrowth, because we're going to be into an insurgence of the free market capitalism again. It's been stymied, and it's got to happen again, or we're going to be in major trouble. So if we have a foundation or basis to work from, that we can not only make money, create jobs, do what we have to do, and maintain the lifestyles that we have, but at the same time, what drives it, what runs it, is something that is virtuous.
Well, thank you. That's a great encouragement.
Yeah, and I think it's really there. Now, we're just about out of time. Theodore, is there a website we can find you in the book?
There is, www, just what the book is called, doingvirtuousbusiness.com.
Wonderful. Hey, thank you so much for joining us. You got a good idea. Go get them.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks. Good night.
Such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. So many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you.
Seth, is the guest up?
I'd give anything just to have one single day there. There, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice. Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk and Dresser After Dark. Matt Whitfield back with his features editor, Yahoo Entertainment. Matt, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me back.
Oh, good. By the way, it is always a pleasure when you're here. We had some fun. We watched Dancing with the Stars. And I'll tell you what, it's a very interesting way to go. You got people who are looking great that didn't, and people who are looking not as good that did in the beginning, and I'm totally confused. I have no idea what's going on.
Well, that's part of the appeal of the show. I mean, and that's why a lot of people are tuning in. It's the second highest rated show, and you never know what you're going to get. And as you just mentioned, one of the front runners early on in this season, Ralph Macchio, he's starting to fade, falling towards the back of the pack, could even be in jeopardy next week.
Matt?
Yeah, there you go.
Yes.
Yeah. Hi. Wasn't sure if I was on, but I am. I'm trying to recall, wasn't he in jeopardy? Well, he was close to jeopardy this week. Actually, wasn't he in jeopardy? Yes, he was.
He was in jeopardy, and yes. Let's be honest, for the past few weeks, he's been slipping. Again, at the beginning of the season, you and I were just so excited to see him out there, but you know, he's not just middle of the pack now. Next week, it's really, in my opinion, I think it's going to come down to Ralph and Kendra.
Well, yes, I agree. I think Kendra got, she did what she can do very well this week, don't you think?
She definitely did. Dancing to Ricky Martin's Livin' La Vida Loca was a good move for her. She got, you know, relatively good scores. She wasn't at the very bottom by any means. She was higher than Ralph and higher than Chris, who was sent home. I think that the judges gave her some more confidence going into this week, and I think that she did a pretty good job. And if she delivers with a decent routine next week, I think that Ralph Macchio is the one in trouble more so than Kendra.
Yeah, if Kendra can deliver. I mean, I don't know that much about Kendra, but the little bit I know, I mean, this was like perfect for her. She did a great job. I mean, there's no question about it.
She had the samba, which is a very difficult dance, but she really knocked it out of the park for her. I mean, again, I'm giving her more credit than I probably should, because when you compare her to people like Romeo or Chelsea or Hines, she's definitely not in that league. So let's not get confused with that.
Yes.
She's still on the chopping block, and we mentioned this the other week. We thought this week either Chris or Kendra was going to go home. Chris ended up going home. So Kendra is still in jeopardy next week. Ralph is slipping to the bottom. Kirstie is not picking it up to the proper level that she needs to be at. And I think without a doubt, Hines, Chelsea, and Romeo are your front runners.
I agree. In fact, that's the number I put. I mean, there's six left. That's exactly the same way I see it. And I still like Romeo. Now, I still believe that Chelsea, I think she should take it. I think she has the whole package. That's my feeling.
Well, I know you've been a huge fan of Chelsea's from the beginning,
yes.
And I wasn't necessarily on board with you. So for the past few weeks, I've been studying her hard, and I really think that she really connects with the audience for me. And she looked great out there last night, paired with Mark. It's just the perfect grouping. They did the quick step to Walking on Sunshine. I thought it was, you know, it was so different from Romeo, who was waltzing to a Celine Dion song. So to see both of them at the top of the leaderboard, not too surprising, but I was kind of surprised to see that Carrie Ann and Abba gave the first 10s of the season last night to both of those couples.
Yeah, I was surprised too. I was too, you know, going back to Chelsea for a minute, being a former ballroom dancer, that's why I say what I do, and I watch her the whole, not just the footwork, the whole package, and she really does, she does have it. Romeo, I think, is incredible, and especially for a young man. I mean, he was the week before last, he was dancing Sinatra. That has to be, you know, for a young person, something that might be a little bit of a challenge. And isn't he a rapper as well?
Yeah, I mean, he's a rapper and an actor. Last week he performed to Sinatra, and the week before that he did the Paso Doble during the classical week, and that's where I really got on board with Romeo. And
yes.
At this point, I'm just really, really excited to see this season Romeo and Chelsea, who are both youngsters out there, really delivering. You know, they're gaining whole new fan bases, and they really are going to give Hines a run for his money. I mean, Hines was the front runner for the past few weeks. He ended up with a 27 this week, which was still fantastic, just 1 point behind Romeo and Chelsea. But I think it's a three-way race until the bitter end.
I agree, and I think, and seeing Hines in third place, I believe that's how I feel where he should be, which is not a bad place. So that should be the three of them. You know, going back for a second to Ralph, I do want to say what he had to experience on the floor this week. I mean, he did a great job getting Katrina up. I mean, what a potential disaster.
I know. We have to give Ralph some bonus points there. I mean, Karina is the one who put them in jeopardy this week. I definitely think that's the case. But if you look at the past few weeks from Ralph, he and Kirstie, I was so excited to see Ralph and Kirstie at the very beginning of this season, you know, 80s icons, kind of like Jennifer Grey from last year. But the two of them, despite the fact that Karina had a flip this week, the two of them are not elevating their game. I mean, they're doing great. They're getting eights. They're getting nines. I don't envision either of those teams knocking out any tens in the coming weeks. I see more tens in the future for Romeo, Chelsea, and Hines.
I agree. I just always like to give credit where it's due with, you know, whenever there's like a wardrobe malfunction, let's call it that. There's such pressure when you're out there on the floor, and when that happens, and especially someone like Ralph, okay, he's an actor and all of that, but to be able to capture that, and he did it so well, that's all.
The other thing we have to take into account here is this is not American Idol where it's just about people picking up, you know, the phones and voting. I mean, in Dancing with the Stars, we've seen a lot of people last longer than they should because people are picking up the phone and voting for them. So next week, even if Ralph does have the lowest scores from the judges, there could be a ton of fans out there that are picking up the phone and voting for him. So you never know what's really going to happen because all of that math behind the scoring and the eliminations on Dancing with the Stars is quite fuzzy, and we never really know what's going on there. So it's really, in my opinion, going to come down to fan bases and support and people picking up the phone. I mean, the judges' scores matter very much, but it's not all about the judges.
Well, very true. I mean, there's always these surprises, but I agree with you as far as, you know, the lineup, at least at this point. And I really can't see Kirstie Alley improving that much. I mean, I think she's doing a great job, but it's not the same caliber.
It's not the same caliber, and we only have a few weeks left. The show is going off the air at the end of May. The next few weeks are going to be very interesting, but at the same time, I think that we kind of know who the next few to go are, and then it's really going to be all about the semifinals and the grand finale where they're fighting for that Mirrorball trophy. Kirstie has done an amazing job. Ralph has done an amazing job, and same with Kendra. But if we're being honest, they're likely the next three to go in whatever order.
Yes.
And the final three, we just know that it's going to be an amazing duel at the end of the season. I mean, everybody was complaining at the beginning of this season that these were nobodies, the casting was terrible. But I
think we were agreeing on that, weren't we?
We were. We were complaining and complaining for weeks. But when you get down to it, a race between Hines, Romeo, and Chelsea, I think it could potentially be one of the best finales we've seen on the show in quite some time.
Isn't that something? I agree.
Matt, did you say that it's going to be over in a couple of weeks? Or they're not going to come back anymore?
Just for the season.
The season. Okay.
The season is ending. Dancing with the Stars will probably be around long after we're all gone.
All right. Now, let me ask you this question. Now, we know what the professionals look at. We know that the people there, what they're looking at, and as people build and they look better and better every week. But what about the audience? The audience, you know, with the people that are on, I wonder if they're there to see Macchio, they're there to see the rest of them, and they really don't care how they dance. They're just having fun with them on there. And I've seen some of the voting that's gone on from the public in and of itself. It has not been for the most professional. It's who they liked and who was entertaining them the most, even if they fell down, it was entertainment.
I 100% agree with you. Look, last season, Bristol Palin, by no means was she the best dancer out there. She wasn't the worst dancer either, but the fact that she made it to the final three and she knocked off Brandy, that has nothing to do with the judges. It has very little to do with her footwork or the way her arms move as she's twirled around the ballroom. It's really about connecting with the audience. The audience is there because they want to see their favorite stars They want to connect with them. They want to see their smiles. And as we discussed, Michael, last week, it's really about that musicality and who can connect to the song and really sell it out there.
You know, I feel this season there's less of the, for me, less of that feeling than there has been in the past, that the people remaining have actually earned it more so than in the past.
100%. This season, the 12th season, is so incredibly different than the 11th season. I mean, we had more drama than we've ever had last year with Bristol Palin and Brandy and the judges fighting with Max. But this year, it's gone pretty much according to plan. It's been a lot more interesting than we thought it was going to be. But as you said, the people who deserve to rise to the top are rising to the top so far, and we haven't seen any major, you know, early eliminations. In the next few weeks, we still could have some surprises, but so far, we're going according to plan with the final three in place for the grand finale.
Yeah, and I personally like that.
Let me talk about Macho for a minute. I got a feeling from him in the very beginning. Remember that scene when he said how much he loved his wife and she was almost in tears out there? This reminds me, just in watching from my perspective, watching Macho, his personality and the strength, etc. In listening to him talk, there's not a lot of power there. And it seemed like it would fall right into play that he would get to a certain point, and then you've got as much as the guy's going to be able to give you, and then it starts to fade out. And I think that's what we're seeing. You could have called it right up in front based on the personalities. You can tell which ones are getting stronger, which ones are going to fade away by who they're, what they're like in the very beginning.
That's very true, but I will say with regards to Hines Ward, I thought that he was just going to be a middle-of-the-pack kind of guy. I didn't think that his personality was going to shine through, that he was just, you know, another football jock out on the ballroom floor. But he really has connected with the audience and gone further than I ever would have guessed. Ralph is definitely starting to fade, and, you know, he had that appeal at the beginning of the season. It was very retro 80s, the way Jennifer Grey did last season. But the difference is, Jennifer Grey was an amazing dancer who almost killed herself out on that ballroom floor each week, and I'm just not seeing that effort put in from Ralph.
You felt Jennifer's pain, you know, and you don't feel that. There's not a strong connection with Ralph.
There isn't. I mean, it's fun when you think about the fact that he was the star of The Karate Kid and he's making his comeback. You know, that's all fine and dandy, but there is no Patrick Swayze sob story the way there was with Jennifer Grey. And she really was the belle of the ballroom last season. I mean, we knew that she was going to the finale from the get-go because her personality was shining through and the audience fell in love with her from the first second she walked out there. Ralph had the opportunity to do something with that, but he really didn't capitalize on it, and that's why I think that he'll probably end up in fourth or fifth place.
Let me say it a little differently. Even in The Karate Kid, the Ralph Macchio is no Rocky, and I think that's where the difference is. There is that inner strength that you can feel with somebody. Even in the movie The Karate Kid, he still didn't have that. Sure, he won at the end, but there wasn't that get-up-and-keep-going attitude that a lot of them have. The football players have that. They have to have that. That's what keeps
them. Well, and Michael, maybe that is one of the reasons why Ralph Macchio's career has also stalled. I mean, he's on Dancing with the Stars, but since The Karate Kid and My Cousin Vinny, we really haven't seen a lot of him for the past, you know, 15, 20 years. And maybe that personality wasn't helping him when, you know, all of those other stars of his generation were going on and, you know, getting bigger movies and bigger TV shows. He kind of faded out. So maybe we're seeing this again. He had, you know, a moment of greatness that he wasn't able to capitalize on because his personality isn't as big as, you know, the people around him.
Yeah, absolutely. Matt, you can only be who you are. And if it's going to come out in dancing, if it's going to come out in some kind of a sport, it's all going to come out that way. And it's with You see, you get to this age, you forget their names. The dancer, the oldest one.
Kirstie.
No, you'd get that one. Yes. Okay, with Kirstie. She doesn't care. She didn't care from the beginning.
That's what I love about it. And she has lost weight. I think she's lost about 30 pounds.
Yeah, but anyways, whether
she's claiming that she's a size 6, which I'm not sure that I believe.
She's not.
But she definitely looks,
no size
she looks
six.
Good for her age, and she's doing a great job, but I'm not buying size 6.
I'm not buying it either.
Okay, maybe on half, one half of her. But the important thing is she doesn't care, and it's
well, she does. You know what? She doesn't. Though there is a part of her that really, really does.
Yeah, but if she loses, so what? I mean, she's going to walk away. No big thing. And it was who was the other one who walked out that she got let go? She's got a talk show on television every day.
Oh, Williams.
Wendy Williams didn't care at all about being eliminated.
Of course, Wendy Williams, when she walked out, it wasn't that she didn't care. It looked like she got slapped in the face.
Well, Wendy Williams also was walking back to a job and a contract. Half these other people are walking out of that ballroom, and they don't know where their next paycheck is going to come from. So some of them need to pay more attention to that than others. I mean, Kirstie Alley has an Emmy. She will always have work. Some of these other people, like Ralph Macchio, they need to take advantage of this opportunity because they do not come around all the time.
Very good point.
Now, you see, they need... See, let's go back to my way of thinking. They need... They need Sylvester Stallone out there.
Hey, he'd be great.
Yeah, and if he can't dance, he'd break the place apart. I mean, you know, this is it. It's all about entertainment.
But wait, speaking of the attitude and leaving, you know what? Chris last night was actually relieved, and he's going to England. I don't blame him. You know, I'm out of here. You know, this is like
a
blessing.
He did a lot better than I expected. I mean, he's a WWE superstar. You know, he still has a career ahead of him. But, you know, I thought that he was doomed in week one or week two. But he really showed a great personality out there. I do think
that
he gained a lot of
new
fans. And he definitely improved. And, you know, his tango wasn't great. But he did a lot better than most people expected. And he should definitely be proud of his performance.
I agree.
John Wayne wouldn't care. Hey, Matt, we're about out of time.
No comment.
Website we can find you at.
You can find my content across all of Yahoo Entertainment's websites. You can also find me on Twitter at Life on the M List.
Hey, yes. Matt Whitfield, thank you so much
for
joining.
See you next week.
Yeah. Good night.
Thanks, guys.
Bye bye. Bye bye.
And the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Well, that's all. Now that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Now that's all. Now that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. Now that's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Gary Gemano with us. He accumulates over 20 years of experience in strategic marketing, IT, entertainment industries for companies such as Avnet, Regional Broadcasting Sales Corp, Voice America, Internet Radio and TV, NBC Radio. And this list goes on, and it's very impressive. And he recognizes the cemetery between business, and listen closely to this, education and entertainment alike utilizing the internet, search engine optimization, and social media marketing, very critical today as their clients' most predominant tools to leverage existing assets, create new streams of income, and have a more powerful outlet to communicate, motivate, and educate. And everybody loves a captive audience, so you've got to have a captive audience to captivate. Gary, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Michael. How are you doing today?
Oh, I'm good. And thank you so much for being here. Gary, when we really take a look at it, it's like if you don't understand how to capitalize an audience today using social networking, et cetera, the SEO, it's like having this massive party and you've spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on entertainment and bands and everybody. I mean, it was just wonderful. And nobody shows up. Well, nobody showed up because they didn't get an invitation.
Well, and a lot of the time, a lot of businesses, a lot of the entertainment industry and educational itself, they have a lot of great things to offer. Yet, if people can't find them, they don't know they exist. And this is why social media has been so much more important today, because, of course, it spreads through millions of people very quickly. And the whole idea is, you know, putting logical solutions out there where we can educate and empower our clients to be able to do this for themselves through education and making it easier to communicate to the world.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, Gary, one of the strongest mindsets that we can have today, if you're going to market, you better know that there's an e-customer out there. There's a brand new mindset out in the world as far as marketing too. They think differently. They're very technologically set, and you can't sell anybody anything anymore. They have to be able to buy it. The internet in and of itself has made everything totally visible. I can find anything I want out at any time by just, you know, a mouse click away. So realistically, you better have it together and you better have enough people that you're going to reach to be able to utilize what you have. Then you get in the marketplace, you can do something with it.
Well, and the thing is, a lot of people get confused by just the sheer numbers alone.
Sure.
You know, you want to put a product out there or a service or the word itself that you're trying to reach a particular type of demographic. The best part about the internet, it allows you to do just that, to find the like-minded people or the interested parties that are already interested in your services or your products. They just don't know you exist. And really giving them the ability to expand their searchable terminology, the keywords in which they're found in categories, and making it a lot easier to get the word out. So
okay. In
reality, yeah, it really is such a great communication tool, as it has been from the beginning as the information superhighway. It just needs to be used properly, and of course, education is the best way to do that.
Okay, let's take it on a practical step-by-step basis. I call Caboodle Ventures, and I've got a business, whatever it is, and I want to do something, but I'm not quite sure what I do. I call, I pick up the phone, I talk to you. Where do you take me? What do you do with me?
Well, if it's a business, let's just say a local business, and they're focusing on local business only. World's a big place, so let's bring this right down to your local community. Well, what you want to do is, of course, get involved with the local business search categories. You want to be in the directories where people are looking you up, and it's specifically found on search engines in your general location, which is imperative. At the same time, the local directory submissions, a form of PR or event distribution if you have something going on. But it's a lot simpler than this. A lot of people have been really convoluting the information due to job security, you know, over the years. But what we're doing is really empowering them to take control of it for themselves and simplifying it by productizing search engine optimization and social media marketing so they can not only see it work for themselves, but they can take control of the reins themselves. Now, with a business, a local business, if you're involved with any social media ping or a synchronization program itself, it allows you the ability to enter information, updates, sales, product information on a regular basis and splash that out to 35 to 50 social media networks all at one time, thus creating, you'd have more time to do other things. You know, it's very difficult to utilize a username and password and input
sure.
that into 50 different locations. So we simplified it, and then we train businesses and individuals how to do it for themselves. And it's really been very successful.
And Gary, what I've seen from over the years, I've been in business and marketing and so on and so forth from whatever degree and whatever angle. In the old days, there was something called 6 degrees of separation. if you had a good product and somebody told somebody told somebody, if you reached 100 people, that would be a lot of people that you could reach. There's a whole different world out there. You get the right place at the right time and you use the right processes, you could be talking to literally hundreds of millions of people. That's why when you talk about increasing your revenue per client, per product, et cetera, because you've got more exposure there. And it's that law of large numbers. The more you're exposed, somebody's going to buy.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's the difference between, you know, having a location in downtown Manhattan or up in deep, dark north Fairbanks, Alaska. You're going to get more traffic. And, you know, traffic is a negative term. And I know we all really roll to that terminology. I prefer to call it an audience because an audience wants to be there. A traffic is filtered through an area. An audience, a captive audience, and what I meant by that originally was it is the people that are already interested in you. They just don't know you exist. And the thing is when you are bringing solutions to the table, we want to make sure that each and every one is customized to each individual. No two companies and no two people are alike. And so each and every solution in which we're prescribing is actually that much more advantageous for their business model. We don't want people to get locked into something long-term. We want them to be able to fluctuate depending upon their demands for their business because it's all about their schedule, not ours. And the thing is with empowering businesses to make it easier for them, they can focus their energies on the more important stuff.
Now, one thing,
and that's why we dropped the veil.
And the one thing that's very important also, it's one of the things that you do is you create a brand experience. That, you know, it's not just I'm the best, I'm the fastest, I'm the most professional, insert your name. Everybody says the same thing. The brand experience is going to cause you to be different when they think of that particular brand that you guys come up with than they think of you and the product, the service, whatever the case may be. I think it's extremely critical.
It truly is. I mean, branding mechanisms. Look at the bigs out there, Coca-Cola, you know, Budweiser, you know, Gatorade, the ones that you get hit with a barrage of commercials on a regular basis. That's how they created branding back then. But now the world is becoming a more visual place. And, of course, when you continuously see identifiers, meaning your company logo or the same look and feel of your website that's duplicated into a Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter format, then it becomes more regular, more of a branding mechanism because everybody is relating to the imagery in which they're coming across. Now, it makes it that much easier to remember as well because, of course, it's a known fact that when people see it, hear it, and read it, they're going to learn it better. And truly, it's back again to education. Educating your clients to, whether it's an end user or a reseller or what have you, to purchase your products and or music or services or whatever you have to offer through familiarity itself.
Yeah, and in the end result, it boils down to this. If somebody's going out to have a soda, you don't say, let's go out and get a soda. For the most part, whatever you end up drinking, it's we're going to go out and get a Coke. You want to blow your nose?
Yeah, yeah.
Kleenex. That's really...
Yeah,
that's
you're absolutely correct.
Yeah, and that's branding. And I think it's very critical that people really take a look at this. When I have been Michael Dresser all my life, all 340 years or so right now, and about, it must have been about a year or two ago, we looked at the internet and we realized that there were seven or eight Michael Dressers out there. There's a doctor, there's a journalist, there's a so on and so forth.
Correct.
So what we did is we started to use my middle name. I became Michael Ray. I became Michael Ray Dresser. And I got to tell you, it was almost unbelievable. Overnight, people have known me for years. I became Michael Ray. So there was the branding, Michael Ray Dresser at Dresser After Dark. See, so there is the branding. We've got something else coming up, but the key is to get yourself separated from everybody else, even if you're selling a similar product, concept, or whatever.
Exactly. Well, and it's distinguishing you from everybody else as well.
Yeah.
And that's with businesses, say, for example, real estate. There's how many hundreds of thousands of real estate agents out there? Well, when you get to certain areas, you have, you know, X amount of companies with, you know, 10,000 realtors selling the same property. how are they supposed to distinguish themselves from anybody else?
Sure.
And truly, it's the ones at which are found quicker. Very rarely will anybody go beyond page two in a search. And usually it goes back to the old adage, you stop looking after you've already found it, right? When you lose something, it's in the last place you look, only because there's no reason to look further. Same thing with the Internet. We're living in a fast food society. The quicker I can get that information, the quicker I'm on and gone to the next subject, right? So, of course, how important is it to be out there online and in a positive, enlightened manner? Well, it's extremely important, because if you're not within the first two pages, being, you know, on page 147 is not part of the marketing plan.
No, absolutely not. One of the things I've said to people for years, now, Gary, I am not a web guy. I have no idea what I'm doing when it comes to a website. But what I do know is the dynamic of how people see it. I've said time and again that when somebody comes to that website, you might have 3 or 4 seconds that's going to cause them to stay or leave, because it's just going to be a multitude of information that people don't even want to hear. So you take the 5 or 6 problems that you're addressing. You get an overarching theme, because if you're working, if you're marketing a certain something, and you said the word solution, if you're marketing a certain something, over the years you have found that the majority of your clientele or your customers, whatever, prospects, whatever the case may be, have very similar problems that what you have addressed. So you take those 5 overarching problems and you put them right up on that that front page of the website, and their eye is going to go right to the problem that's specifically them. That's what keeps them there. Of course, you've got to keep them there after you get them there, but you just said it. Stop looking when you found it. And if you found it within seconds, that's going to cause somebody to move through the website.
Oh, exactly. And that's what creates more conversion rates as well, because it's all about numbers. And I hate to say that, because, of course, we're all individuals and we're not numbers. But when it comes down to it, the more like-minded people that are interested in your products or services already, the more conversions you're going to get. Instead of blanketing the world, knowing that, you know, you're going to get 2% of returns, if you're going to the people who are already interested, it makes it a lot easier to present your solutions and get more sales just due to that. And it really betters the numbers through and through, and it really helps knowing where to go to do it.
Sure. And also,
you know, we live in a... I'm sorry.
Go ahead. It's going to go on for about a week. We got just a little bit of a delay, so we might find ourselves falling on each other. But go ahead. Go ahead and talk.
Well, of course, you know, marketing is imperative for any business, any individual who's looking to be someone, right? Now, marketing is also not difficult. Marketing I compare to treading water. You know, it doesn't take a lot to keep your head out of the water. You just have to move your hands around a little bit, right? But as soon as you stop, what happens? You sink.
Oh, you sink.
And it's the same thing with the Internet, because you have a lot of competition out there already. So if you don't remain current and you don't do the simple things to allow yourself the ability to compete properly, then you're going to get buried. You're going to get really overrun by the masses that are out there already. And truly, it's just all about keeping up with current information, entertaining, and something that is actually informational, educational, something that people like to pass around as well, because everybody loves to share great information.
Sure. And there's a key here. Most people create marketing and they create presentations and speeches, and it's got to do with the thinking that if their audience understands what they're saying, it's going to capture it. That's not so, because when you really come down to it, Gary, it's not what you understand, it's what you recognize within what's being presented that's going to cause you to take that that action step for whatever direction you want to be. Buy the product, go to the seminar, workshop, website, whatever the case may be. It is that moment of recognition, and it's a millisecond that causes it, is that rush of dopamine that you know that there's a fix with inside of what you just heard. That's the call to action, and that's people calling themselves to action, and we can't do it anymore. We have to set it up in such a way that they call themselves to action through recognition, and all of a sudden you got clients and prospects and I forgot the word I wanted to use, getting older, and customers. That's the good word. How could you forget that word? The customers that you may not have, that you may not have had before.
Well, and the thing is, too, is once again, it was just to simplify this, to make it easier, because, you know, in today's society, people are either too busy, too lazy, or they just don't know what to do. And we've kind of filled the gaps in with that and taking out all the guesswork. And, you know, I got to give a lot of credit to my partner. He's one of those uber geniuses, Christopher Conlon, that helped us put together something that could be very comprehensive, extremely affordable, and be a heal-all for most areas that can cross-pollinate effectively. It creates linking strategies back to your online properties with your social media marketing. And, you know, search engines actually deem this as being important when you're found in multiple areas. You may have noticed some of the search engines changing right now. Google in particular, they got this big left-hand column down, you know, with the news and shopping and mall and what have you down the left-hand side. And now all of a sudden, there's the ability of having like buttons that are incorporated to a search engine, very much like a social media network. There's a reason for this. Because of the flow of information that's coming out, people want to cut to the quick. They want to know who's who and check out product reviews and know, get the feel of how a company is, how they treat their clients, where they're looking to go, and how new media technology has changed the industry to make their lives simpler too. And when it comes to the fact of taking social media from online to have a social life offline, it makes life a lot more conducive. And that's all about simplifying it, making solutions easy, make it empowering, and give them a true opportunity to represent themselves competitively.
I think that really sums that up, because that in and of itself is really the magic to the whole thing. Gary, we're starting to run out of time. Is there a website we can find you at?
There is a website. It is CaboodleVenturesLLC.com. We have a wonderful spread there for a lot of different products for business packages, social media marketing, talk shows, musician packages, real estate. And we really did take it the extra step. We invite everybody for a peek at the site to go ahead and review their opportunities out there to see how they can position themselves in now and in the future. And, of course, we're always willing to take calls.
Great. Gary Germano, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time.
I appreciate it, Michael. Have a great day.
Good night.
And the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime. And a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Susan Marshall back. She's an author. She's a speaker. She's the president of Executive Advisor LLC, independent consulting firm founded in 1997 and specializes in leadership development and executive effectiveness. She has assisted leaders in public and private sector industry, nonprofit agencies, public education for nearly 30 years now, and her work is dedicated to building strong leaders who in turn create successful organizations, transform school systems, and develop leaders at all levels. She is the author of How to Grow a Backbone, 10 Strategies for Gaining Power and Influence at Work. Welcome back, Susan Marshall.
Hi, Michael Ray.
How are you?
I am very well, thank you. How are you?
I am good. I want to set up a scenario here, okay?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
I'm in war. I'm in the middle of a war zone. I am the commanding general. They do what I tell them to do, okay? And the enemy is attacking. And I'm saying, okay, maybe we should attack. If we could sit down here for a bit. Well, how was that for a segue?
it's funny. You know,
yes.
And as I was listening to you kind of read the introduction for me and my work, it's ironic sometimes when we talk about executive effectiveness and building strong leaders that every now and then we have to look at, acknowledge and deal with the flip side.
Yes.
And the flip side, you know, that we'd like to talk about tonight is the dangers of weak leadership. And your scenario is perfect because when you're in a war, and unfortunately so many circumstances that we find ourselves in today, we start characterizing as war, unjustifiably so. But nonetheless, you know, you're in a war and the enemy is attacking, and you're going, have a commission. No. I was in a meeting recently that I want to tell you about because I think your listeners will relate. And then I want to talk about not just what the dangers of weak leadership are, but how do you survive it, right? So first of all, the meeting. It was the meeting of an advisory board for an organization that included the CEO, and the advisory board is made up of members of the community at large from different businesses and different organizations, which many governing boards are, and I want to make that distinction. This is not a governing board, it's an advisory board. But some months ago, the CEO created a new position for this organization or for this part of the organization that deals with new product development, right? Companies now are saying, how do we generate new revenues? How do we get a competitive advantage? Well, many are looking at new product development. So that's what this body is all about. The CEO, a number of months ago, had created a new high-ranking position and then hired a person into this position without consulting the advisory board. So, that feels kind of peculiar. The advisory board is not happy, obviously, to not be included in this kind of a decision. But we were in a meeting a number of weeks ago with this advisory board, and I had been invited in as kind of a spectator. The leadership work I do, I knew the advisory board chair and said, hey, you know, would you mind if I sit in just to watch the dynamics? She said, no, sure, come on in. So as the meeting unfolded, there was another person from the outside who had been brought in to talk about a new product that their company was developing. And this person, innocently enough, said, gosh, you know, we all in the community know about this new person you hired, and congratulations. Would it be possible for us, the community, to get some role clarification about this new person? Because we're not really sure what you brought her in to do, and it sounds as though she might be duplicating or perhaps replacing, you know, one or several of your current executives. And the advisory board had not up until that point been included in the conversation, knew nothing about it, but they chimed in and said, gosh, yeah, that would be terrific because I've heard this in the community. One of the women said, I was in the grocery store last week and was asked, has our executive director left? So this was not long. You know, it went on for, I don't know, 3 or 4 minutes.
Sure.
The CEO was clearly uncomfortable and displeased and distressed with this conversation, and said he would consider the comments, but really did not commit to doing anything particular in answer to the question about role clarification. So the meeting, you know, proceeded to a close. Later that day, the CEO's right-hand person contacted the chairman of the advisory board and said, how dare you allow such a conversation? Well, the advisory board chair is thinking, how dare I do what? The right-hand person characterized this brief 3 to 4 minute discussion as an attack on the CEO's decision-making and wanted to know why and how the chairman of the board could allow this discussion to continue. So first of all, the representation of the boss being attacked was erroneous. It was an innocent question that triggered a conversation that should have been had months before. The second point was that this outside person who asked the question had no right to challenge the hiring decision of the CEO. Again, it was an innocent question. The third point was that the CEO had no intention of being railroaded into changing his hiring decision. So again, that perception of being attacked. And finally, that the confusion in the community, yeah, not real. So just huge denial. So as I sat and listened to this and reflected on, you know, the challenge afterwards and the supposed chastisement of the advisory board chair, I thought, you know, the CEO, if it's true that he felt personally attacked by an innocent question, that's cause for concern. That he was unable or unwilling to clarify his decision for the board members was also a red flag. The board obviously starts questioning, gosh, if he did this without telling us, what else is he doing, right? Trust is eroded. And the advisory board members, because they're all volunteer members, because it is an advisory, not a governing board, are saying, you know what? Why am I giving my time to this? So you can start to sense the shakiness of this particular division of this organization. The right-hand, so those are dangers of the weak CEO, right? The dangers of the weak right-hand person would be the catastrophizing of a discussion that was 3 to 4 minutes in length, that expressed a genuine concern and an interest into an attack on the CEO, stirring up all kinds of trouble. An implied threat to the advisory board chair, fall in line, right? Why didn't you control this? Fall in line or else. And finally, the question about the CEO. Is he too weak to respond effectively? So you can see the many, many pitfalls of weak leadership. Not unlike your, you know, leader of an army in the enemy.
It's also another area of concern here, and it's in communication, because the key here is this: was it rhetorically? Now we both know the answer, but was it a question or was it an accusation? It wasn't a question, as far as the CEO felt, it was an accusation,
right.
And that
right.
Everything started to tumble down.
Well, that's exactly right, and that's a very perceptive point, Mr. Communicator, because the CEO obviously was uncomfortable with the entire scenario. Had he said, I'm looking to bring a new person in, I'm looking to add this asset, if you will, to the organization, who would have had a problem with it?
Yeah.
They might have asked the same questions, but had the conversation happened prior to the hire, it would have been a completely different situation. And the fact that the CEO felt compelled, for whatever reasons of his own, to create the position to bring this person in, but that's part of the problem, right? What was the motivation? What was the true intent? Are the advisory board members truly valued, or are they simply placeholders? And so that's very, very, yes, the intent was critical. Yeah. The question was innocent enough. At least as I perceived it.
But it wasn't a question.
As an attack.
It was not a question. Let me bring this thing home. I have dogs and cats here. My sister,
yep.
I get up in the morning and I feed the cats. And my sister, she's running around doing her stuff, and then she feeds the dogs. Now, when she mm-hmm. first moved in with me, I would say to her, now remember, this is between you and I. I don't want everybody to know about this.
Right.
Okay.
I won't
gotcha.
Tell.
All right. Good. Otherwise, I would never have said it. Okay, so I would say to her, did you feed the dogs? Now, in the very beginning, and this is a natural response from 99 9/10% of the people out there. What do you mean, did I feed the dogs? What am I, shirking my responsibility? Yada, yada, yada. Okay.
Uh-huh.
So we got to a point now where she knows if I ask a question, it's did you feed the dogs? Because the end result, the purpose is do they get fed or don't they get fed has nothing to do with you as an individual. That's the same thing in business. When a question is asked, it is a question and it is not an accusation. And if it's an accusation, it's very simple to say, is that an accusation or is that a question and what's behind that? It settles it right now. Unless the guy you're doing it with is like 6'4", and then you don't say too much.
Well, or you ask, and then you kind of stand back.
Right, and you kind of back off.
But the point here, and yes, you're absolutely correct on that. The point here is that a weak leader is unprepared for even an innocent question, and that's dangerous to an organization. If the leader, the CEO in this case, had some reservation. And clearly, apparently did, because of the discomfort of the question, because of the characterization as an attack, et cetera, that suggests that there's more to it and raises the question, what else? Which is hugely detrimental to an organization. And yet, I'm quite certain that you have, I know I have, and I suspect that many of your listeners have been in similar scenarios where there are weak leaders protecting their backside or, you know, holding people at bay so they're not challenged, they're not questioned, and they simply do what they believe is right.
It's called what's the focus also. You know, and realistically, a strong leader in a condition or circumstance like that, they go to the powers that be and say, okay, why are we hiring someone? And let them talk. Get it out of the front. There's a problem.
Exactly.
You address the problem now, and if there's not a problem, you know exactly what it is, and you move, and everybody is focused. But when somebody is afraid to ask the question, then everything that you just said happens, and I would venture to guess that happens 9 out of 10 times because everybody's so worried about what they're going to say about me.
Well, from my experience, it is maybe 9.5 out of 10 times.
Gas is not $4 a gallon here. It's $3.99 and 9 tenths.
No, it's 4:05 here.
Oh, well, you're 100 miles away, aren't you?
Well, I'm 40 miles away. it hit the 4:05 mark today. Amazing.
Oh, did it? Oh,
And so why? What are the drivers? Well, you know, the answers are obscured by all kinds of reasons and blaming and blah, 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 blah. And so we are left with the decision to trust or not trust, to believe or not believe, to accept the circumstances or to challenge them because we don't believe something. We don't believe the honesty of the leader, we don't believe the competence of the leader, or we don't believe the intention of the leader. Those are the three elements of trust. And when we start feeling that icky feeling in our stomach, we have to say, what is it that I'm feeling? Do I not trust the honesty? Yes or no? In this case,
it's a very simple way to handle it. Well, no. Mm-hmm. There's a very simple way to handle it. It really is. You get everybody together. You get the leader in front, and you say, "Okay, three things I want here. One, I want your birth certificate. Second one, I want your law degree."
Yeah. There you go.
Did you say that?
Why is that hard? Why is that difficult?
It's not hard.
For commoners
it's not.
Like you and me, we don't see anything outrageous about that request. We don't see anything problematic about that request. And when it is stonewalled for whatever reason, now we have issues. So let's flip the coin over and say, okay, let's say that you are in a situation where weak leaders kind of rule the roost. What are some things you can do? What are some things you should do? Number one recommendation is to strengthen your confidence through experience. Remember a couple weeks ago we were talking about confidence?
Yes.
Without confidence, you have very little chance of being effective or even being healthy in the midst of weak leaders. So when you say strengthen your confidence through experience, what does that mean? Get out in the world. Look for different experiences. Look for other points of view. Listen to people who believe differently than you do. When you have a broader perspective on things, you are less likely to feel victimized.
Yeah.
Second, practice presenting.
Wait. You can only feel victimized if you're a victim.
Yeah.
inside.
Well, but you can tell yourself a victim story that is not true. And sometimes that happens just because you hang around a lot of people who are telling victim stories.
Yeah. We see it every day.
Yeah. So strengthen your confidence through experience. You can't think your way to a stronger position. You've got to learn. You've got to grow. You've got to overcome some challenges to recognize that you can. I think we've talked about this before. How do we make people's learning obvious to them so that they recognize, gosh, I learned something. I'm in a different place. I'm stronger. I don't have to fear this, right? Second, then, is to practice when you're presenting information, when you're asking a question of a weak leader, present your point of view as information worth considering rather than as absolute truth. Oftentimes, and I'm sure you've seen it way more than I have in all of your interviews, when people feel challenged and they're not confident, they're not strong, they take it, well, the CEO in this case, takes it as a personal attack. And then you're defending your absolute truth. It's an emotional investment. You don't have to do that. Here's my perspective. Here's my point of view. It's worth considering.
You know, I had a guest on, about a year and a half ago, and I can't remember what her name was. And then every time I would hit her with something that put her against the wall, you know what that sound is like when you hit the numbers on your telephone and go beep 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 beep.
Yes, yeah.
That's what she would do.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, Michael Ray, I didn't hear you.
Pardon?
Oh, that's funny. I didn't hear you. Yeah, beep 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 beep.
Yeah. Beep beep beep, yeah. And she, what was her? You would know her name. She was the one that Cindy, she had the pink movement. Her son had died in the war, and she went against
who was picketing Bush all the time.
Right? Yes, Cindy something. But that's
Sheehan?
Who it was. What say again?
Sheehan.
Yes.
Sheehan.
Yeah. That's who.
Oh,
it was.
You interviewed her.
Oh yeah. Yeah,
oh,
and there was a, because every time I got into something she didn't want to get into, she'd hit the button.
Yeah, isn't that it? Well, there's a demonstration. She was declaring herself.
Sure. Now, by the way, what is someone afraid of? What are you afraid of? I know. What are you afraid of?
Well, you know. You tell me. What am I afraid of?
Nice way of getting out of it. You're afraid of the unknown. You're a human being.
Yeah.
And when all of a sudden the unknown becomes the known, you're not afraid of it anymore.
That's very, very true. Thus, the experience. Go
absolutely.
Find it. Go see it. Go hear it. And recognize that when you leave that scary unknown place, you're still whole. You are still okay. Got
it. It has nothing to do with you as an individual. It has to do with the mindset. It has to do with the concept. It has to do with everything that you're frightened to death of, that somebody triggers in you, that you recognize. Now you're ready to go hide behind the door because you don't want to stand up for yourself and commit to saying what you think.
That's a beautiful point when in the context of this discussion of weak leadership, because weak leaders cannot do that. And because they're leaders, because they have power, they will put people who make them uncomfortable behind lead doors.
Yeah.
They will put them away. They will put them someplace where they can't challenge and thus destroy the entire organization over time, which is
how I can get you uncomfortable? Human being, okay? Mm-hmm. You know how I can get you uncomfortable? Demand the truth out of you.
Right.
That's it.
Right. Yep.
Yeah.
Well, in those words, tell me the truth. What?
Yeah, sure.
What are you asking me for? Why are you challenging me?
Yeah.
With those tell me the truth words. What is it you want? And those are all the defensive mechanisms that come up. You're right.
Yeah.
And from leaders, very, very scary stuff. So here's one that's a tip. That's really kind of one of my favorites. When you encounter a weak leader and you've discovered through, you know, observation and experience with the leader that he or she is weak, be polite and be cordial, but do not show deference. This is a bit of a controversial point when I talk with people about this. Showing deference, people will say, well, that's respect and we need to respect leaders. Well, no, We don't.
Not leaders.
They are not deserving of respect. We do not need to respect them. Do we need to be polite? Do I wish people would be polite and cordial? Yes. That says nothing about respect.
We're just about running out of time, and you know we could probably talk all night. So
all night.
let me ask you this: website we can find you at
www.executiveadvisorllc.com.
Hey, we will see you next week, and I'm going to practice to be a leader.
Please don't be weak.
I'm trying.
Thanks, Michael Ray.
Okay. Good night.
Good night.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark.
All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories.
Autumn Stringham with us. She's the author of A Promise of Hope, A Woman Affected with Bipolar Disorder and the Miraculous Treatment that Cured Her. She's the second of nine children born to a mother who suffered from bipolar affective disorder. She developed the same illness, and the story of the remarkable treatment that had been featured in a documentary entitled Impossible Cure on the Discovery Health Channel, popular women's magazine, and her book, again, A Promise of Hope, an astonishing true story of a woman affected with bipolar disorder and the miraculous treatment that cured her. And let's say, Autumn, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when we talk about bipolar disorder, I am quite confident there's more people affected by it with many, many different degrees, and there's a lot of people that don't even realize that they have it.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's becoming one of those kind of catch diagnoses, too, I think, where people accuse others of having it when, in fact, they don't. So it kind of goes both ways, doesn't it?
Sure. If I don't like the way you are, it will accuse you. That's what you got.
We can throw it out as an insult, too, can't we?
Yeah, we can do it politically. I mean, it works for them. What the heck? Let me ask you this question. When was it that you realized that you had the bipolar disorder?
Look, I had problems from, some of my earliest memories. Suicidal at 10, had all sorts of mood issues and was called all sorts of names in the family group, you know. I think I realized I was sick when I found my mother hiding in her shower in an awkward situation where she was fully clothed and obviously having a psychotic episode and was just terrified and terrifying to find her like that. I was 16 at the time, and I recognized that she really wasn't okay. And then I recognized that same thing in myself. So I wasn't actually diagnosed until I was 21. And
on a practical level, I'll just stop you just for a minute because I want to lay a base here. On a practical level.
Sure.
What is it? What is it? What are some of the signs, the symptoms that somebody has it that you can you'd recognize it?
Well, I think we all recognize what depression looks like. You know, true clinical depression, where someone is just incapable of accomplishing things; they don't even want to anymore. It's like they just want to sleep all the time. They can't function. Everything just feels like a big burden. Bipolar is like that on the low end, and then there can be sudden swings or just a gradual swing. The times spent in the depths of each mood can be very short, or they can be extremely long. Some people even go for seasonal type swings. But the thing that makes depression manic depression or bipolar is when you swing into the high and you go beyond normal feel good into elation, into grandiose thoughts. Sometimes people get confused and think that they are far better at things, better looking, smarter, richer than they actually are, and that can cause a lot of problems in a family setting. A lot of destructive
Jekyll
behavior.
And Hyde. Kind of a Jekyll and Hyde.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and for me, you know, in the early stages of the illness, it really seemed like a seasonal thing. I was living in Canada, in the far north, where there really wasn't a lot of sunlight, so it was common for people to have depression in the winter, just the lack of sunlight. But it wasn't until I got into my late teens and early 20s when I started swinging very rapidly. And that was undeniably not seasonal. But, I could swing from a super high, elated mood into a suicidal depression several times a day. And that's when my diagnosis was called rapid cycling bipolar disorder, which is really dangerous. Most people that commit suicide, I understand anyway, that most people that commit suicide as bipolar people do it during a rapid cycling period.
Just as a whim at the time. Now, let me ask you this, allopathic medicine, chemicals. Obviously, you went to regular doctors. They didn't work, did they?
Oh, I mean, it did work on some level because I didn't kill myself. And I'm not anti-drug because I recognize that when you don't have a better option, sedation is a really good option. Sometimes if all they can do is just make you stay in bed and not go out and do something that's super destructive or life-threatening, then, you know, that's a decent option. I tried 13 drugs over 3 years. I was hospitalized several times and was in the hospital or in the doctor's office at least once a week for a variety of issues. Usually when I would go into a really high mania, I would have hallucinations that went with that. And that's not always the case for people with bipolar. I was really extremely ill. But, I'd have to go and get a sedative shot at times like that. And that carried on for a long time. And, you know, I didn't get any better. I mean, I stayed alive, but I didn't really feel like I was living. And any time that I could think a clear thought, it was really, how am I going to get out of this? And, how am I going to die? And during that period, my mother committed suicide. She was 40 years old at the time. And then it came to light that we'd actually lost my grandfather to suicide as well. So there was an obvious pattern in the family, and it just got to be pretty hopeless for me.
Now, where was it that you found the light at the end of the tunnel, where you found that something could finally work? And I don't mean management work, so you can have a decent life.
Right. Well, this is where the story gets good, and that's why it's a good book. My father ended up talking to a guy. They were volunteering for their local church, and they were standing in a church hallway, and he starts talking to this guy that he barely knows about me and about my younger brother, who was also diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And my dad was describing my younger brother's behavior, and the man said to him, "Your son sounds like a pig with ear and tail biting syndrome." And he went on to describe how for 20 years he had been developing this vitamin and mineral regimen for the big pig farms, for swine farms in southern Alberta, and how they were able to manage pig behavior through nutrition. And, of course, my dad jumped all over that because the medication didn't work for Grandpa or my mother or me, and it certainly wasn't working for Joseph, my younger brother. And they got onto this, and eventually I was in my dad's custody because I wasn't allowed to be alone with my son, and it kind of just wrapped up into this situation where I had a violent outburst, and he felt like he was justified in forcing me to take the supplement, and over a period of a few days, he got me started on it, and the turnaround was phenomenal. Within 2 months, I was off of a 5-drug cocktail and back at home. Without adult supervision.
Yeah, but Autumn, what's in it?
It's vitamins and minerals in a very specific combination. It's actually been researched now at universities around the world. They've got 15 medical journal publishings now. They had to take on the Canadian government to make it legal up there because some of the laws said you can't use vitamins and minerals to treat certain diseases because they don't believe it can work. But it is it's gaining momentum in the research community, and it's going to take a while before it gets into the medical system. It takes a long time to have that take hold. But there are thousands of people in North America now, like me, with stories even better than mine.
It sounds like you were talking with the lack of sunlight up in the in Canada, you know, the long winters. I spent, 20-some odd years in Fairbanks, Alaska, long winters.
Ooh,
vitamin
yeah.
D3, you know, and D3. And there's a lot of people who don't take the D3 vitamin because of your lack of sunshine, it can have its effect on you also. And I can imagine that the different combinations of vitamins would change brain chemistry. And it's brain chemistry that's just going to throw you off.
Yep, and you know, there are micronutrients that, I mean, the World Health Organization has done incredible research on nutrients in our food. And what they've discovered over the last 50 years is that what we used to be in a tomato isn't in a tomato anymore, just because of our growing practices and depletion in American soils. So we are minerally bankrupt in America. And in North America,
lycopene from tomatoes and so on and so forth. No, absolutely, absolutely. You're not getting the nutrition in the food that we once got. Try this out. By the time you sit down with something at the dinner table, from the time it took, and if it's all natural, whatever the case may be, from the time it took from the original creation of it to your dinner table, it's going to lose a tremendous amount. Then if you have a digestion problem, it loses even more. So supplementation today is really the answer to many, many things. See, whatever you're talking about is not a cure, and it's not a be-all, end-all. But what I'm hearing you say, and stop me if I'm not a clinician, but what I'm hearing you say is that that if you fix the immune system, if you shore that immune system up, the immune system is going to do the job it needs to do to fix the problem. Did I lose you? Are you still there? Beep, beep. I love beeps. Oh, where's my tinfoil? If I have tinfoil, they can't get. Okay, not a problem. Okay, so we're really talking about nutrition, and in so many, many cases, nutrition is really the place to go with a lot of things. It is amazing if you pick up some of these books about what to eat, what's inside of what you eat, and the effect on the body. Unbelievable. Oh, we lost you for a minute. We got you back, Autumn.
Okay. Good to be back.
Thanks, we missed you. So realistically, I think where we were going is, if you can get things that will cause the immune system to work, that's where the cure is.
It is. And the brain function and enzyme functions, all sorts of things are based in micronutrients. And, you know, I'm not a scientist. I don't understand all of that. But I can tell you that when I started taking the right nutrients into my body every single day, and got off of the medication in a safe way, it changed everything about the way that I think and feel.
Yeah.
We went on, my husband and I managed to stay married after I put him through it like you wouldn't believe. And our son, who I had during my illness, is now 18, going on 19. We've got three more girls, and we are living a healthy, happy, middle America family. Like here in Idaho, we're just having a wonderful time together, and there is peace in our home. And I think that's the message I really want people to know, is that we're not just talking about a new drug, a new idea. It actually works and allows you to get into a situation chemically where you can change your behavior and really be happy. And I never imagined that would be true. Growing up the way I did with my mom, never imagined I could ever be happy.
Autumn, by the way, going through these things, if there is even if it's a debilitating disease that somebody in the family gets, if one person in the family has something, the entire family is affected. It's not just that one person.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody may not have the disease or the imbalance themselves, but they're going to get affected by that person who does have it, and the entire family is affected.
Absolutely. It is a disease for the whole family. You know, and this is one of the things when I'm doing public speaking, I raise this a lot. There are the physicality of the illness is one thing, and you can deal with that with medication or with nutrition or however. You change the body, you change the brain, right? But
sure.
There's also the habits of mental illness that people learn. I was raised by a woman who had really serious problems with mental health, and her parents did too, and there's that whole genetic connection and the whole behavioral familial connection.
Yeah.
And that is the pattern that needs to break. But you can't ask somebody to change their behavior when their behavior is making sense to them. So you really have to change the chemistry first.
Oh, absolutely. How many people could have had a decent life? How many kids that did not have to go out and join gangs because there were problems at home, etc.? If they, yeah. I know this is going to sound so simple. If they would have eaten properly and taken the right supplementation.
It's true. I'm speaking at a thing with a researcher from Canada in Utah later on this fall. I'm going to be speaking at a thing for incarcerated women. And, you know, they've done some studies on criminal behavior and even violent behavior in jails and discovered that there's a huge connection between nutrition and those kind of behaviors. And it just makes you wonder how many people's lives could be different if someone, yeah, had been able to break that chain down
sure.
the line, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No question.
I'm breaking it here. I'm excited about that. My
Wonderful.
Children are never going to be mentally ill, you know?
Love every second of that one. Autumn, we're starting to run out of time. Is there a website we can find you at and get more information?
Absolutely. You can go to apromiseofhope.com. That's www.apromiseofhope.com. That's also the title of my book, A Promise of Hope. And it's in the United States now and available through regular booksellers. It's published by HarperCollins. So I hope people will read it and get some hope and figure out how to take care of themselves and their families a little better.
Wonderful. Hey, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated the time. Go out and get them.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
Good night.
A dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms. I know the magic of her charms because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone.
Seth, do we have a guest?
Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Someday, I don't know how, I hope that she'll hear my plea. Some way, I don't know how, she'll bring her love to me. Dream lover, until then, I'll go to sleep and dream again. That's the only thing to do.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Brandon Wade with us, founder and CEO of the website SeekingArrangement.com and SeekingMillionaire.com. He's an entrepreneur. He started numerous internet and mobile companies, as well as a retail and tour business. Prior to these endeavors, he served as a management consultant with Booz Allen and held executive roles at several Fortune 500 companies, including General Electric, Microsoft. Originally from Singapore, Brandon moved to the United States to study at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where he graduated with both a BS and an MBA degree. And since then, he's lived in Boston, New York, Seattle, New Orleans, San Francisco, and mostly recently in Vegas. And he is the author of the book, Seeking Arrangement, the definite Guide to Sugar Daddy and Mutually Beneficial Relationships. Brandon, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Thank you for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Now we're talking SeekingMillionaire.com, SeekingArrangement.com. We're talking about a dating service, aren't we?
Yes, both are dating services. Seeking Arrangement is for sugar daddies and sugar babies. Seeking Millionaire is for those who are looking to date a millionaire.
Ah, okay. Now, I'm sure you get loaded with those.
We should do, actually. And of course, the newest site that we just launched, which is whatsyourprice.com, and that's also a dating site.
Okay, now, in internet dating today, you know, there's got to be tons and tons of people. I remember years and years ago, you know, if you weren't married and you didn't know anybody, finding a date was a very hard thing to do because you had maybe two or three people to choose from, which was not a great range of people to choose from. Now, with the right place, my goodness, there's tens of thousands of men and women out there looking for dates, and you can put them together and somebody can go out and be happy.
It's just a lot easier today with the internet because you no longer have to troll the bars and the lounges, and then you have to worry about how you're going to approach the person with a corny pickup line. Whereas now you kind of are hidden behind the screen, and you could do it at the comfort of your home or office, and it's just very simple to just simply click a button to connect with someone.
Okay, now you've got 300,000 unique visitors that have hit the website. Also, 20,000 members on whatsyourprice.com. What caused it to get that exciting so quick?
Well, I think it's the controversy. I mean, the controversy leads to a lot of coverage about the website.
Yeah,
and it's also very... Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, when you say controversy, what kind of controversy?
Well, whatsyourprice.com is about paying for a first date. So... members either join as a generous member, those who are willing to pay, or the attractive, which is somebody who's willing to accept money to go out on a first date. So the idea of paying for a date or accepting money for a date might seem similar to, say, an escort service, which is where the outrage comes from the media. But it's actually very, very different. Whatsyourprice.com is about compensating somebody who's attractive for their time to have an opportunity to break the ice so that they could now spend an hour or two to get to know you better.
Okay, so in essence, realistically, what we're really saying here that if you're willing to pay for a date, that means that you are that you're going to put your all into it. If you're going to pay for it, you're going to tell them who you really are. You're going to send them the real pictures and everything else. And if you're paying for the date, who's going to show up on the other side is going to look like and be like what you're paying for. So you're really qualifying it here.
I think it's a great way to qualify and filter people because if you're willing to pay, you're probably extremely serious about wanting to find that person. And on the other side, well, certainly if you're attractive, you're going to get bombarded with messages on any dating website. So this is a great way to kind of filter through the hundreds and hundreds of messages you get, drill down to the actual people who are serious about meeting you and who are willing to compensate you for your time because, after all, time is money. And for a woman, preparing for a date is a very costly proposition. Think about it. A woman has to pay to get her hair done. She might have to spend money going to a nail salon to get her nails done. Then she has to put on makeup and, you know, certainly dress appropriately to impress and then drive to her date, which costs money not only in terms of gasoline, but in many other ways.
Well, Brandon, let me ask you this question. Okay, so let's say that I join, right, and I'm going to pay for a date. So I pay for the date. We have a great time, and we decide to go out again. Do I have to pay her the next time, or is it just the original time?
No, this is really just for paying, just to pay to break the ice. So it's really just the first date. Now, the idea is that you have an hour or two of one-on-one time, and you'll be able to impress that person so that they can now have enough information about you beyond just that photo or that profile to make a decision as to whether they like you enough to want to go out with you the second, third time, or even to have a relationship with you down the road. The payment is only for the first date.
Okay. Now, by the way, I think it's a brilliant idea. When did you think about it this way? Where'd you come up with it?
Well, it's from my own frustrations using normal dating websites, to be honest. I think I have very high standards, like most of us guys. I mean, we're visually attracted to women who are beautiful. And as you know, the demand and supply is such that there's a lot more guys looking to want to date those beautiful women than there are beautiful women out there. So on a regular dating site, I would write hundreds of messages, and I would not even receive a single response. So I'm paying $50 a month, doing that month after month after month with no results and being extremely frustrated as well as lonely. So I thought, well, there has to be a better way. So we did some market research by getting over 20 beautiful women into a room, and these are all single women, and we would show pictures of men to them and ask them, well, would you go out for a first date with this guy or this guy? And a lot of them would say, no, I'm not interested in him, just from that visual picture. But when we started offering them money by saying, well, what if we compensated you $10 or $20 or $30 to have that 1 hour coffee so you could get to know that person better? And as the money sort of goes up and up, eventually everyone in the room would say yes. So we realized, well, this concept definitely does work because everyone has some level of price for that 1 or 2 hours of their time. And after all, it's kind of very innocent. It's a first date at the end of the day.
Yeah. No, by the way, I'm enjoying every second of this. I think it's a great idea. So really, effectively, that's where whatsyourprice.com came from. There is a price for doing so. And if they get along on that first date, then it's up to them for whatever. Now, obviously, if you've got 20,000 people, you've got it broken down from the location to location to location. I think a lot of the internet dating today is all over the country. It is very hard for somebody to travel 20,000 miles for, you know, a Friday night date. So is it, have you got it boiled down to location?
It does, and I think more people tend to meet locally, obviously, because, and the numbers are now about 50,000 members. It was 20,000 about 2 weeks ago. Now we have about 50,000 members, and we've actually arranged over 5,000 dates. Most of these dates are occurring in bigger cities, like, you know, Los Angeles being one of the biggest one, and, of course, New York and other places. But it's centered around cities where people can travel to actually meet for a first date.
Okay, let's say, for instance, that I get on the website and I join for whatever price it is. Now, I'm on the website. Most of the websites, you just join, that's the end of it, and then you're on your own, and you have a date, don't have a date, whatever the case may be. Now, do you vet me? Do you check me out? Do you make sure that I'm the kind of person that you're going to put together with someone else, whether they're paying for it or not?
Well, actually, we don't do a lot of the checks at all. We're relying on our members to do the checks for us. And because the website is so focused on that actual initial real meeting, people are going to find out about the other person. So if you upload a photo that's really not you, we're going to get told, you're going to be reported. Or if you end up being extremely rude on your first date, we have had some reports of those, and we have had to boot members off the site because of those reasons as well.
Sure, because what we're looking at right now, obviously, you've heard about it, I've heard about it, most people have, the controversy with Match.com right now. You know, it's the screening situation now. She's not looking for money, which I think is very interesting. She just wants them to check out everybody that joins, and that's going to be a tough thing to do. That could cost them more than it's worth being in business for.
Well, it's also almost impossible. Imagine now going to a bar, and now the bar owner having to check every single person. Well, it's actually easier in a bar because they do have to verify you with an actual ID before they let you in. But on the dating site, the only information we can go with is really that payment information, which is your credit card information. And not everyone uses their credit card to pay for an upgrade per se. So it's almost impossible to make sure that every person is who they say they are. There's no real way to check.
Sure.
To check that, or to make sure that that's happening.
Okay, but do you have any liability? And when I say that, anybody who's got a dating site, it would seem that there must be some. You'd be opening up yourself for liability, because if you're setting it up where somebody pays and then they've paid to be on the site and then something happens from there, how do you guys protect yourself? And I'm saying that innocently.
Well, there are quite a few things that we do. Obviously, as a business, we have insurance to protect ourselves from those situations. But beyond that, we do our very best to tell our members and to inform our members on what they should or should not do. So when a member logs onto the site, on the very homepage when they log in, it's a list of common sense things that we tell them to do. For example, meet somebody in public where there are lots of people. Don't go somewhere private with that person before you actually know them. So there are things that we can do. And of course, we will look at how Match.com and the other big guys, you know, ultimately they're going to come up with a set of best practices in terms of how they screen people. I think there's still a lot of loopholes there. So at the end of the day, it's going to boil down to every individual's sort of common sense. You know, take that safe approach. Be safe and sorry. And you'll be able to avoid a lot of those issues or problems.
Oh, no question. So it's going pretty good so far then.
What's Your Price is doing extremely well. And we've been receiving feedback from members, both females as well as male members, who are literally becoming addicted to the website because I've had a member who used a regular dating site, and he was telling me he's actually a very good-looking guy, so he has had no issues finding dates on other sites, but it's taking him quite a long time and effort to write to all these girls and then to wait to hear back from them. On seeking on whatsyourprice.com, within the last 2 weeks, he has arranged a date for himself every single night. So he's able to screen through all these women in a much, much faster manner than he was able to on other sites. So people are relatively happy.
Okay, so effectively, and he's paying for every date.
He is, but this is the interesting thing.
He's sort of giving...
The dates range from anywhere from $20 to $100, and he's realizing that there's some girls who are asking for quite a bit, $200 or more. But you know, sticking to a budget of between $20 to $100 is what we tell people because that's a reasonable amount to pay, and you kind of know that the woman who's asking for anything around $100 is probably looking for a serious relationship.
Okay, so in essence, if you just want to go out with somebody, have a cup of coffee, have a drink or something, $20-$50 will do it. If you're going to get really serious, you're going to end up spending some more money out there.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
Yeah, okay, I see nothing wrong with that. I think it's an absolutely great idea. And now you've got a lock on it because the idea can be so good. Can somebody copy that idea now?
Well, people can certainly try to copy the idea. We have a patent pending for the process by which we allow people to negotiate on the price for the date. That process is patent pending. But there's obviously other methods in which people can, you know, can implement the same sort of concept. One way I was thinking of is you could use the same concept offline. For example, you're going on a speed date. And everyone pays, the guys and the girls pay. And I've been on plenty of speed dates, and unfortunately not all the girls are very attractive, and I spend a lot of time, you know, going through, meeting and talking to all the other girls I have absolutely no interest in getting to know at all. What if we ask the men to pay more, and instead we pay the women who show up, and we kind of screen them to make sure that they're more beautiful? So the same what's your price concept can be applied to other forms of dating as well.
Okay, no, I think it's phenomenal because an entrepreneur today, you have to have an idea that's different than everybody else, and it seems as though you've got something, and with the amount of people that are joining, becoming members, and the amount of hits that you're getting, obviously, you've got onto something that's extremely good, and I think it's a great idea. Let me ask you this. Brandon, is there a question that I didn't ask that I should have asked you that would have brought more information up that the audience needs to know? Did we miss anything?
Well, the only thing is that, you know, there's a shock factor. I mean, obviously, we picked the name whatsyourprice.com as opposed to payforfirstdate.com because it's more sensational. And the media is certainly eating that up and using that, you know, to their full advantage to pull in the sensationalism and to write words like escorts or prostitution in the headlines because that captures people's fascination and attention. But beyond all that, once a person sort of looks at the concept and goes, you know, goes beyond the initial wow or the ooh and understands rationally why people might want to exchange money for a chance to meet the other person, then they realize that, wow, this actually makes a lot of sense. And it's not only a good way to filter through the information and the people, but it also attracts people who understands that time is money. And if you value yourself, then it's actually okay to do this.
And it makes sense. Brandon, we're just about out of time. Website we can find you at?
Whatsyourprice.com.
Okay, www.whatsyourprice.com. Brandon Wade, I think it's a heck of an idea. I thought it was really creative. Go get them. I think this is wonderful. I'm going to track you guys to see how you do.
so much, Michael.
Okay, take care, Grant. Brandon, good night.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Then there's nothing in the world can hurt us long as we're singing our song.
Give me trumpets, legato.
Put some saxes with them.
Strings, pizzicato.
Add some rhythm. The world's all right and everything's swinging. Long as we're
hey, thanks for listening. And if you're listening really intently, tell all your friends about it, all your colleagues about it. That's the way we grow. That's the way what we call networking. I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.